Well, hello and welcome to Radio. I'm your host, Ray Weaver, and sorry about last week. Some of you didn't get a podcast, and some of you radio listeners got a rerun. But I actually had eye surgery. I went in for what I thought was a relatively simple procedure, and my doctor noticed that there was something going on with my right eye, so quickly sent me to an eye doctor to take a look. They found a small tear, I guess, in the back of my eyeball. Laser surgery to fix the tear, and no screens, no reading, no anything for a week. So I don't read anything on here, but I couldn't be looking at the screen to make sure that everything was working. But had a lot of time to sit around and do not much, listen to other podcasts, watch some TV, and I got to thinking, as I often do, about country music. I spent a long time of my life playing in country bars. I don't want to call them nightclubs, taverns maybe, bars. They were interesting places. And I wound up there, I'm not really sure how. I mean, I'm of an age now, 67. I grew up listening to the Beatles and the Stones and Kinks and Bob Dylan and Donovan. And that was my music. My dad was a huge country music fan, as was my mom. And they listened to Hank Williams Sr., Merle Haggard, Tammy Wynette, you know, Carl Smith. I mean, people that were long forgotten now. That was their music. And I can't say that when I was listening to WISZ radio, 1600 on your radio dial, 1590 AM, that I really was crazy about it, but it was my dad's Ford Falcon station wagon, and that's what you were going to listen to. You were going to hear Merle Haggard. You were going to hear that music, you know. I'm proud to be an Okie from Muskogee. You know, that was coming out of the thing there. And yes, I purposefully have one of my least expensive and not quite in tune guitars with me, because I'm going to be talking about playing in country bars. And yeah, some of those guitars were a little out of tune back in the day. But that was my dad's music, my mom's music. And I heard it, of course. And they had friends. Now, I've been in bands for a while now. I'm getting into my 18th, 19th year. And they had friends that played in country bands. They had friends that played the local taverns, the local bars. And I would go out and see them. Now, some of these bands were quite good. I remember one band that we saw a lot, probably their favorites. They all wound up becoming good friends. The Country Cavaliers. Now, this is spelled with a K, the Country Cavaliers. You have to remember that. That's very important. And they had Denny was the lead singer and acoustic guitar player. It was kind of, you know, there were a lot of people in and out. Not a lot, but a few fellas. Don was the fiddler. He was a great fiddle player. Jim was the steel guitar player. Dean Bush, Dean, he played bass and he played piano. And the usual drummer was the Mighty Mo. And let's just say what Mo may have lacked in finesse as a drummer, he more than made up for in power. And this was a pretty powerful little country band. And they were pretty well known and well respected in our little neighborhood. You'd go out and see them on a Friday and Saturday night, and they could put on a show. And I made up a little bit of song about years ago. I made up a song about them. I can't remember all of it, but it was like Friday night heroes and Saturday superstars. Find them every weekend in little honky tonks and bars, picking sweet, sweet country music for a dollar and a brew. And they'll drink up most of their earnings before Saturday night is through. I should try to refine that song. It's really not all that bad now that I think about it. Anyway, they were guys that I knew. And there's a certain truth here. I mean, I was playing by this time some pretty serious hard rock, you know, Deep Purple, getting into the glam thing with T-Rex and David Bowie. And yet I had a couple of bands together and we weren't getting much action. So I said to one of the bands, which would later become the Last Chance Band, I said to one of them, let's try some country stuff. Let's learn 20 country songs and try to get a gig at a country bar. I mean, how hard can it be, right? We'll go up and audition for a few country gigs and then see, we can slip our music, the stuff that we really want to play, in between, you know. And I think back on it now and I realize that a big part of me just wanted to play some music where my parents would come out and see me play, where they would enjoy the music that I was doing. And that was important to me. It was important. So we did. We learned a bunch of country songs. And no, it wasn't as easy as it sounded. It wasn't, we weren't really in any way, shape, or form, especially at the beginning, any kind of authentic. I mean, you know, we're playing Merle Haggard and Hank Sr. songs, and I've got at least 3-4 members of this band that have never heard this kind of music before. They've never listened to it. They're young kids. They grew up with Elton John and that kind of stuff. The piano player was basically an Elton John clone, wore the big glasses and the suits and everything. So he's over there, you know, with his piano doing Benny and the Jets riffs in the middle of, Your Cheating Heart. So, but it was great fun and we got better and we, of course, yeah. Some members left. They were like, nah, this is not what I signed up for. You know, I signed up for Rebel Rebel and maybe Sing Me Back Home or Green Green Grass of Home is not what I want to be doing. So they left and we got some other people. We actually started to get some gigs. And I don't know about now, but in the old days, the way you got a gig is you went to like an audition, you went to a club, and said, hey, man, you know, I got a little band and, you know, we'd like to get some gigs at your place. And that worked to a certain degree. That worked to a certain degree. But, you know, really everything, especially back in those days in the country scene in Baltimore and Pasadena and that part of Maryland, was about connections, man. It was about knowing somebody, literally about knowing somebody. And so you hung out. You went out on the weekends and you hung out at the little clubs and you got to know the waitresses and you got to know the bartenders and maybe the manager and maybe the owner, because a lot of those little mom and pop nightclubs that had country music, they were, you know, owned by a couple or a guy, or maybe they were a couple at first and now it's just the guy or just the woman. That was a lot of the clubs that I played at. Those were the people. Bill and Mary owned a bar where I grew up called the Hard Hat. Now that's what it was called. It was called the Hard Hat. And hanging on the wall as decoration in the Hard Hat were hard hats. Working man, working class hard hats of every description, of every size, of every shape, damaged, dirty, whatever. They were put there because this was a working class bar. This was the Hard Hat. Now, you can imagine how much this little country bar that was called the Hard Hat and offered up cheap beer, no food, peanuts, pretzels, pickled pig's feet, eggs, pickles on the bar, pig's feet on the bar. You can imagine how much patience they had with my long hair, liberal claptrap nonsense if I was in there. That would be none. That would be none. And so I just kept that to myself, kind of tried somehow to miraculously make my hair look shorter than it was. I often wore hats in those days, so that was one way. But also, I was a neighborhood kid, so they accepted me as quirky, but also they accepted me as a musician. And I was very respectful of the culture in a way, because my dad was a very working class guy, blue collar guy. As I often say, you know, some of my friends' dads wore ties to work. My dad wore a shirt with his name on it over the left pocket on the breast there. So, you know, I respected the culture, and quite honestly, I loved the music. Now, the regular weekend band at the Hard Hat was the amazing Johnny and Gene and the Dixie Drifters. And I am not making this up. Johnny and Gene and the Dixie Drifters. And I remember a guy named Keith played bass. A guy named Bobby, I think, played in the band. No. Bobby played bass. Keith was a guitarist. That's right. Can't remember, but I remember Johnny and Gene. Johnny was old, which means he was probably my age now. I'm 19, 20, 21, and I'm looking at this guy. He's up there, and he's wearing a sparkly Porter Wagoner kind of jacket and slacks with a white shirt and a bolo tie and the absolute worst comb back Ernest Tubb kind of toupee you've ever seen in your entire life. All of this, now all of it, his jacket, his shirt, his pants, his white leather boots, all of it is not new. It's well cared for. It's well loved. You can see that it means a lot to him. But it's not new. This is a honky-tonk bar off Fort Smallwood Road in Pasadena. This is not a high-end place, buddy. So there's Johnny, and June is next to him. June is also 60-ish, at least. And June has kind of a tight, she was a thin woman, thin, older lady, had a tight, sparkly kind of sequin thing going on with a dress or skirt and a sequin top. And then she had that hillbilly hair, man. She had that hairdo that was reached for God. And we have a couple of euphemisms for it that I won't use on the podcast or on the radio, but it, the higher the hair, the closer you are to God. And it was hard. Let's just put it that way. I mean, had somebody thrown something at June's head, the bottle would have broken on that hair. And that was Johnny and Gene and the Dixie Drifters. And they were terrible. Johnny couldn't sing to save his life, and neither could June. And Johnny's guitar style could basically be summed up with, he's one of those guys that played everything like that at 300 miles an hour. You're cheating, huh? We'll make you weep. You'll cry and cry and try to sleep. And just every song, I don't care if it was ballad, I don't care if it was a shuffle, I don't care if it was a slow tune, fast tune. Now, there were no rock tunes. They weren't going to do any of that rock in there. And they weren't going to do any of that new country that was on the radio. They're not going to do any, in those days, Eddie Rabbit or anything like that. They were real country, and they made that clear when you came in the door. And so they would be there Friday and Saturday night, and I wanted to get my little band a gig in there with Johnny and the Dixie Drifters. You know, I thought maybe, they can't work every weekend, right? They can't work every weekend. They have to take weekend off every now and then. So I thought we could get in there and play some stuff and maybe get a gig. Now, we were not going to fit in, clothes-wise, culture-wise, whatever. I mean, I was the only one that was willing to make some kind of concessions to that sort of thing, because I like those kind of pseudo-cowboy clothes anyway. I mean, I was only a pseudo-hippie, so I might as well be a pseudo-cowboy as well, right? I just wanted to, you know, get the gig. So I'd go in. They got to know me, and in the country bars in those days, it was pretty much the culture that if you were a singer or a picker or whatever, the act would get you up for three songs at the end of a set. Usually not the first set, second set, probably three songs. They did four sets, which was usual then, nine to one gig. You know, you would get up at the end of the third set. But now this is the thing. This is really important to remember. You don't come in at the beginning of the third set expecting to get up and do your two or three songs at the end of the third set, because there'll be other people that got there before you and they're going to get their songs and you might not get your songs. So if you're going to get your songs with Johnny and the Dixie Drifters, you got to be there when they start. They start at 9, you got to get there at 8:30, you got to order your drink. Now for me, and remember now, I'm underage. I can't drink. Drinking age in Maryland, it was 21. I'm in this bar, you know, probably drove up myself in my station wagon, 68 station wagon with a mattress in the back. More on that in another podcast. And so I'm sitting there with a Coke, you know, sitting there with a Coke and 8:30, and I'm meeting all the guys in the band and all their wives. Now, remember now, this is a cultural, this is a night out for the band and their wives. If they had a wife or a girlfriend or whatever, the wives and the girlfriends would get their own table and sit together, watch the band. And, you know, of course, Johnny and his wife, they were on stage together, but the bass player and all of them, they were there. And now we're getting to the point with these folks that some of them have their own children who occasionally come out and see the band. And the children are like right there in my age bracket. And some of these children were quite attractive. And there'll be maybe more on that later on, too. But anyway, I'm sitting there, you know, I'll get my three songs and wait to get my three songs. And I learned some, you know, pretty traditional country stuff, real basic, you know. The old hometown looks the same as I step down from the train. And there to greet me is my mama and my papa. So, you know, and they would play behind me. As I said, now Johnny and Gene, the singing. But the pickers were pretty good. You know, Keith was an okay guitar player. Bob, a good bass player. I have no idea who the drummer was or if there was a steel guitar player. I can't remember. It was a long time ago. So, you know, it sounded pretty good. And Bill and Mary, the owners, they had taken a liking to me. They had seen me there a lot. And they knew my family a little bit. My mom and dad would come in when they didn't go see the Country Cavaliers. There'll be a whole lot more stories about the Country Cavaliers coming up and the Red Rooster Inn and people riding motorcycles in the middle of the honky-tonk. All of that is on the way. You don't want to miss any of these stories. So remember, like the podcast. Give it a review. Five stars. Five stars. Count them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Give it a review. I'm sorry. I shouldn't do that in the middle of the story. But anyway, they... you know, I'd get up and do my songs, and Bill and Mary took a liking to me. She said, you know, coming up sometime in the summer, the band was going to take a night off, weekend off, and my little band, which didn't really have a name yet. We had been toying with a lot of names. One of the names that we came up with was Idiot Wind, which is a Bob Dylan song, which would not, just not fit here. Not fit. So it would not fit here. So... we tried Speakeasy for a while, but that was conjuring up too much blues in Chicago and stuff like that. So I don't know where. There's all kinds of legends about it. I don't know who came up with it first. I think maybe my brother. I think maybe Ken came up with it. Sort of in the conversation, it's like, man, we got to do something with this. This is the last chance we're going to have, you know? And so there was the Last Chance Band. Now, this is not the classic Last Chance Band lineup. Again, this is myself, my brother, piano player that looked like Elton John, a guitar player that looked kind of like somebody who should be in David Bowie's band, and a girl singer who was a great folk singer and a great Joan Baez, but maybe not so much of a Tammy Wynette, if you know what I mean. The two things just didn't cross over, but we tried. We tried. So we get our gig, and we go there, and we're playing the songs. You know, we're playing the songs musically. We're pretty tight. You know, Greg was a good piano player, and it was good. It was an okay act. You know, we were okay. They hated us, man. They absolutely hated us. I mean, these rednecks did not like us at all. And I don't say rednecks as a derogatory term. To me, those are my people. These were my people, you know, and they just, no matter what we did, they did not like us at all. Now, the hard hat was not going to be our home base. I was going to be allowed to come in there and get up and sing my three songs in the third set on a Friday and Saturday night, but the Last Chance Band in that version was not going to be a regular at the Hard Hat. It was not our time. Our time had not come yet. We were not a good country band. We were not a good folk band. We were not a good rock band by any stretch of the imagination. We just weren't a good band. We played, I don't know how to describe it any better than that. We played okay. We sang okay. It was all okay, but it wasn't good. And of course, all of us being younger and looking like we did, not that there weren't any young people in there, there were, but these were those young, old people. These were people that were old the day they were born. These were these people that took on their parents' thoughts and ideas and image and everything right away. And they were old. They knew that they were going to be working, you know, pickup truck jobs for the rest of their lives. And they were happy with that. And they were happy with, you know, that genre and that feeling and that whatever. And they had nothing to, even though we were the same age, we couldn't cross that chasm, couldn't feel it. And anybody that's been in a honky tonk like that, anybody that's been in a bar room like that, anybody that's spaced like that knows that, those chasms can not only be hard to cross, but they can also get aggressive when people don't like you and they're drinking 25-cent beers and they're wanting to hear, you know, Johnny going, "Blue Moon of Kentucky, keep on crying," you know, and we're up there doing a country version of a Bob Dylan song, or Karen was singing a country version of a Joan Baez or something like that. They, you know, we weren't giving them what they wanted, and we didn't want to be there. we wanted a gig. We wanted that $25 each a night for the weekend and the free sodas. But the Hard Hat, God love it. I loved being there, and I met a lot of people there, and had a lot of fun there, got into a lot of trouble there, but it was not going to be the base for our band. That was down the road for us. That was going to come up at places called, and I'm not making this up, the Pumpkin Patch, the Country Palace, the Millersville Inn, the Wheel Inn, the Desert Inn. Ah, man. Those were the days. I don't know what the scene is out there anymore. I don't know what the scene is for country bands anymore. But once we got okay, once we got decent at it, you know, we could work a lot. Because especially in that period there where the urban cowboy things started to happen, even clubs that were rock clubs would start having country nights, you know, cowboy nights, because they wanted to get that audience in, because there was a lot of people doing line dancing and two-stepping, and more about that later. I hate that stuff. I got to tell you right now, I hate that stuff. And that, for those of you that are members of those kind of clubs, I'm sorry, but that kind of stuff for bands back in the day was death, because that meant you could only play a certain kind of music, and it attracted an audience that really didn't care about the music, didn't care about what you were playing. as long as the beat was there, that they could line dance. That's my dog, Max, by the way, that's driving me crazy and doesn't want me to finish my podcast. But I am going to finish my podcast, and I'm going to finish talking to you guys. I think that, you know, what we'll do here, maybe, is we'll stop here and let you guys, let me go do whatever it is Max wants me to do, probably take him for a walk, and let you guys marinate. I see you, Max, and they can hear you. Marinate a little bit in Johnny and Gene and the Dixie Drifters and the Hard Hat, and we'll continue on next week with more from the country music world out there in the day. Some really interesting stories, crazy stories, stuff that you're going to go, ah, come on, man, that can't be true. But it is. I'm Ray Weaver. This is Radio. That's Max. Remember my book, A Father's Heart, on Amazon. Remember to rate the show wherever you get it. Radio folks, people out on the actual radio, you know, the modulated thing. Thanks for listening. And we'll see you next week.